Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How well do you handle yourself under extreme stress? Could you talk a violent and desperate person out of hurting innocent people and protect your suspect's life at the same time? Amazingly, such extraordinary challenges were a fairly normal part of Gary Noesner's work life for 23 of his 30 years with the FBI. He took part in negotiations to end the Montana Freeman and Republic of Texas sieges and was in charge of negotiations with David Koresh during the time that people were freed from the Branch Davidian compound. Gary Noesner retired in 2003 as chief negotiator for the Federal Bureau of Investigation and now works as a risk control consultant. His new book is called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Gary, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
I really can't imagine a more stressful job. How did you think, this is my life's work?
Well, when I was becoming an agent, this field of hostage negotiations was brand new, and I received an orientation on it in my new agent's training class, and I said, this sounded like something very challenging and interesting, a specialty that you could make a difference in. And so after I'd been an agent for about 5 years, I had the opportunity to get the training, which was then fairly rudimentary compared to where it is today. But I found it to be one of the ultimate challenges and something that was really fit my personality, and I enjoyed trying to help people get out of really tough situations.
What's really interesting about this book is that you get the sense instantly that it's much more about listening than it is about what you have to say.
Yeah, I think there's a misunderstanding that the public has, often based on what they see on television or in the movies, that the negotiator is some sort of a fast-talking, slick con man in his or her own right. In reality, it's about listening. In probably 90% of the cases that law enforcement negotiators respond to, we're dealing with people who are emotionally enraged. They're angry. They're frustrated. They've had some sense of loss of a relationship, a job, or whatever it might be. And in those cases, we have to really project a genuine interest in hearing what's going on with them, hearing their side of the situation, and becoming empathic. And that allows us then to earn the right to be of influence with them, to steer them away from violence.
That seems like a really tough line to balance on, because on the one hand, you have to have some genuine interest in this person. On the other hand, you have to have enough professional distance to achieve the objectives that you're there to achieve. Did it feel sometimes false one way or another that you couldn't care as much for a person as you wanted to because you had a job to do?
Well, I think it's certainly a challenge when you're in some cases dealing with a pretty despicable criminal that's perhaps done some pretty bad things. It's particularly acute when police officers have to negotiate with someone that has killed another police officer. But I always try to detach myself from what they've done, and I try to say, I want to get this person out alive. I want to resolve this situation in a manner that won't set up a situation wherein a police officer, another police officer, is injured or killed or other innocent life. So I think you have to be genuine in your desire to want to see everybody come out of this okay.
Was it typical for you to go in armed with a lot of information about the person's background and what had gone on? Or how often was it you were sort of stepping in cold and trying to figure out what the deal was?
Well, in most cases, you don't have nearly enough information because these are spontaneous events that occur. And then you're very quickly trying to collect information from friends, relatives, associates. You're trying to build a little bit of a history and a profile of this individual, how they coped with stressful situations before. And a lot of these things are keys to helping determine what's the best strategy. In other cases, like the Montana Freeman, where we knew well in advance that we were going to conduct a raid against them, we had extensive portfolios about them in advance, their criminal histories, their mental health histories, if known. So, but that's more rare. In most situations, you're kind of learning about the person on the job.
Do you ever get to make eye contact during this?
In some instances, there is a face-to-face situation, but not to sound too humorous, but we like to say in negotiations, we've never had a negotiator killed over the telephone. So it's we really prefer that method because it's safer for everyone involved. In some cases, the police or FBI will get up close, but always in a barricaded and safe position if possible.
There was one case where you were literally at the bottom of a stairwell, and you had somebody with two hostages upstairs and in a room off the hall?
Yeah, it was a man holding his former common-law wife and their child, and they had a very acrimonious, tumultuous relationship that spanned many years, and he had actually kidnapped the child on one prior occasion. He kidnapped them in Connecticut, and we ended up finding them in an abandoned farmhouse, as it were, in Virginia. So I was in the bottom of this 100-year-old farmhouse at the stairway, and he's upstairs in the bedroom with the woman and child, and so I projected my voice for our negotiations, which lasted over probably 12 hours. So a tough case, and a case that ended up where we had to use deadly force to kill him in order to save the woman and child. But sometimes negotiators, most of the time, 90%, high 90s, we're going to be successful in avoiding any further loss of life. But a negotiator also has to be prepared for the fact that there will be some cases that won't end the way we want. And then we have to kind of moderate our position to support the most effective and risk-effective and successful resolution that'll save the most lives, which may be a tactical entry.
As a negotiator, are you ever thinking about evidence that you might collect that might be used in a prosecution of a suspect at any point in the future? Or is that something that you really can't concern yourself with?
Yeah, pretty much not. I mean, that's normally a task left to others. Obviously, if we're negotiating with someone, those things that that person says over the phone could have an impact in any criminal prosecution. But as a negotiator, I put that out of my mind. My job is to get people out alive. It's somebody else's job to pursue a prosecution if one is merited in the case.
What pushes somebody to go and do something that leaves them in this sort of desperate, cornered position where they feel like they have no choice but to commit some horrible act, and you've got to convince them that there is a different way out of it?
Yeah, well, Chris, when I first got into the field, we called it hostage negotiations because all the training was focused on someone purposely holding a hostage to compel somebody to do something. And the classic scenario is the bank robbery where the police show up and now the robber's trapped inside with customers or employees, threatening to kill them if the police come in and also threatening to kill them if he doesn't get a getaway car and money. We have enormous success rates in those cases because the person came there today, as it were, to make an illegal withdrawal, not to have a confrontation with the police. Mm-hmm. And in almost all cases, they end up wanting to live more than they want to die. And after time, and hence the title of my book, Stalling a Time, they come to see that they're not in as much control or power as they thought. But that's only about 10% of what we do as law enforcement negotiators. The other 90%, as I mentioned, are situations where the person has no plan to resolve it. They've gotten into an emotionally charged event. Their employer has fired them, and they're holding a gun on their employer. They've been picked on in school. Their relationship has gone bad, and the woman typically is going to leave with the kids, and the man won't let that happen. So in those situations, in essence, the negotiators show up, and the only thing we hear is go away and leave us alone. Mm-hmm. So that requires a whole different set of skills, active listening, empathy building kind of skills to demonstrate you're respectful, you're genuine, you want to see them come out. And it takes time, but we're also successful on those to a very large extent.
Your title, Stalling for Time, could be interpreted two ways. You're stalling with the individual that you're trying to talk down from something like this. There have been times during your career when you've also been stalling for time with other law enforcement officers who wanted to take a different tack.
Yeah, you know, when I teach negotiators, the very first thing I teach them is self-control. And self-control is obviously very important for a negotiator. If I can't control my own emotions, how can I expect to influence someone else? So that's an absolute requirement to be successful. We also have cases where law enforcement officials may not be able to exercise sufficient self-control and put pressure on negotiators to do something different, or there'll be officers on the perimeter that might take aggressive action that unintentionally subverts the process of building rapport. So negotiation is not just often with the person we're dealing with that's inside of a barricaded building, but it's also with management at the scene to make sure they understand what the negotiation team is doing and why we're doing it.
And management also can feel pressure from the media, because when you were at the height of your career, suddenly we had the ability to put up these 24-hour feeds of crisis situations taking place.
Yeah, I think in almost any major event today, a hostage situation is a news focus. And 24 cycle of news, cameras are going to show up, satellite trucks, and it gets a lot of attention. It's a lot of drama involved. And I think there are instances where police can feel pressured to do something, to be seen as being in charge and being decisive, when oftentimes we're not able to do much and we have to slow it down. We used to tell commanders we're engaged in dynamic inactivity to give a fancy word to the process of we're just slowing this down so we can de-escalate, gather more information, assemble better resources. And when we're more patient and professional like that, we get better outcomes.
Would it help if all law enforcement officers had pretty extensive training in this, even if it's not what they're going to end up doing with their careers?
Well, I think compared to when I started in this business, almost any police department of any size now has trained negotiators and negotiation teams. The knowledge base across the country for negotiators is quite significant. There's training conferences and a good exchange of information. The persistent problem that you hear from negotiators around the country is, I understand all these things. Our team functions on these bases, but our bosses don't understand. Mm-hmm. So I think the probably the biggest and greatest need is for police officials, police commanders, FBI special agents in charge to really have a better understanding of what and why their negotiation team is doing what they do. Many of them obviously understand, but there are many that don't.
Gary Nestner is my guest. He's former chief negotiator for the FBI. His new book is called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. We'll resume our conversation with him in a few minutes and talk about his time at the Branch Davidian siege in Waco. Right now, though, we want to pause to ask you to lift yourself from this really interesting conversation just for enough time to call and make a contribution of support to KERA. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. And, you know, listening to this conversation, I wonder if our friends over at the Dallas FBI are listening in. I'm sure they're really busy. They're very, very busy. But we do have the 12th largest FBI unit here in North Texas. And it's really interesting the work they do. And I think this is a fantastic conversation for the show. Please tear yourself away. Because now it's just Chris.
You have a guarantee for the next 2 or 3 minutes that it'll just be Jeff and me.
Yeah, it's just me and Chris, and we're just asking you to call 888-694-6931 or go online to KERA.org. Still looking for about $6,000 to make our goal for the show, but we have copies of Gary Nestner's book, Stalling for Time, available today. When you join the station, you can get your very own copy at the $120 membership level. It's just $10 a month if you become a sustaining member of the station at that level. And, of course, the book's out. It's available. I'm sure he'll have copies at his event tonight with the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. But we will do the shopping for you and thank you with this if that's how you would like to support the station.
Really interesting piece of reading. I was telling Gary in the break, Jeff, that you had already read the whole book before you even said, would you like to do the show? So if this is the sort of thing that interests you, it really is a very interesting glimpse inside what this world is like. We would love to hear from you now at 1-888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org in support of all the worlds that public radio gives you a glimpse into. You know, we love to be able to explore ideas and areas of people's expertise that we wouldn't necessarily encounter in our day-to-day lives. That's the great thing about public radio. And it's great, Jeff, that we get to do it for an hour at a time per subject, and we don't have to get 2 minutes of highlights and then move on to something else.
I agree. That's why you're listening. That's why on Wednesday, the third week of the membership campaign, you're still listening to the station, because you know that even though, and maybe let's look at it from the side where you've already given, you who's listening to the station now, you've already given, so you know we're not talking to you anymore. So your contribution's paying off when you hear these conversations. Of course, we're still coming to you in between because there are other people who listen who still haven't given, but you have. But if you haven't, take this moment right now to call 888-694-6931. Take this moment right now to go online to KERA.org and make a contribution in support of these kinds of conversations that you just don't hear anywhere else but public radio.
1-888-694-6931 is the number. You can also go to KERA.org and choose at the $120 contribution level or above a copy of Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator, the new book by Gary Nestner. There are also a variety of other thank you gifts if you are interested in something different. A lot of you say, no thanks, don't need a thank you gift, put my entire contribution to work paying for this content that I love so much. That's great too. We can accommodate it however you want to do it. We do want to hear from you though, online at KERA.org, or if you prefer, at 1-888-694-6931.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former chief negotiator for the FBI, Gary Noesner. His new book is called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can learn more about that appearance at dfwworld.org. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Gary, you described the siege at the Branch Davidian compound as one of the proudest and yet one of really the most upsetting events of your career. And we should say you were not there at the bitter end. 32 people got out while you were in charge. But can you talk about how it started for you?
Well, I got a phone call. I was out with my family at a hardware store in Northern Virginia where I live. And someone at FBI headquarters told me there'd been this terrible shootout between ATF agents and the Branch Davidians in Waco, a group I'd never heard about, and that I was to proceed to an airport and jump on an FBI plane and come out, which is what I did. So I came out really with a relatively scant amount of information about what had happened and who this group was. That quickly changed. But I think I knew I was arriving at probably the absolute worst scenario because we had 4 ATF agents killed, I think 16 or 17 wounded, a number of Davidians killed as well. And you basically had a group that believed that the raid fulfilled their prophecy. Mm-hmm. They're coming to get us, and they were prepared for that. And the only thing they wanted of the FBI that was now on the scene to try to resolve this situation peacefully was to go away.
So there's not much to negotiate with.
So
at
there
that point.
It seemingly is not a lot to bargain with, that's for sure. But the approach we took was to try to demonstrate to the Davidians that this was the FBI, that, and we did this with ATF's acknowledgement. We tried to purposely separate ourselves, say, okay, you're going to get a fair hearing in court. They had some grievances in how they felt the raid had taken place. We said, you're going to have an opportunity to tell the world your side of the story, to present your situation in court. And so we slowly began to listen to what they had to say, to show genuine respect. And we got 35 people out during the first 26 days when I was in charge of negotiations, including 21 children, which I'm very proud of. And it was very difficult to conduct the negotiations to get those kids out. At the same time, you talked about the external pressures. I think there were some officials in the FBI that felt, this made us look weak. It was taking too long. It's too expensive, millions of dollars a day. Why can't the FBI just go in and arrest these people? So those kinds of pressures and criticisms, both external and internal, were pushing a side of the FBI to take on a more aggressive approach, which I opposed. I was replaced halfway through, and they began to be more aggressive in terms of some of the external activities outside of the compound.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. You're replaced because it's customary after several weeks of high-pressure work to switch out the teams to keep people fresh.
That's right. As the chief negotiator there, they probably could have asked me to stay longer, but it was not on the surface unusual that I was replaced. But I think there clearly was an undercurrent that I was an impediment, perceived as an impediment to a continued negotiation approach that some perceived as taking too long and being too slow. So I was replaced and another coordinator was brought in, and no one else came out during the entire ordeal. The FBI eventually put in tear gas to try to induce or incentivize the Davidians to come out. And as we all know now, the Davidians started the fire that brought about their own demise. We had been concerned about a suicide situation all along. We continually asked David Koresh if that was his intent, and he denied that it was. But it was a very, very tough case, and one that had an ending that nobody wanted. I'm very proud, as you mentioned, of what we were able to accomplish. I'm very disappointed, and I'm very critical of the ending because I believe, as a negotiator, I don't necessarily expect us to always be able to get everybody out unhurt. But we need to get out everyone that's possible for us to get out. And on that criteria, I think there's more people we could have saved, perhaps even all, had we stuck with the negotiation approach that we were on to earlier.
Did David Koresh strike you as mentally ill, as delusional, as murderous?
Yeah, a lot of people almost paint him like a Charles Manson type character. I didn't find him that way. Obviously, when we first arrived and I talked to him in the early hours, he was very angry, particularly at ATF. But he would also talk about secular matters. He would joke with us from time to time. If you looked at his personality like a pie chart, there was a sliver of maybe, maybe an eighth of it or perhaps a bit more that was really into his religious ideology. And we found pretty quickly that any attempts to talk with him rationally in that sphere was destined to failure. Mm-hmm. So we tried to steer our conversations to more secular, practical, day-in, day-out matters. And it was in those conversations that we secured the release of children.
Getting the kids out first, obviously, was a huge concern. And you also thought maybe parents would voluntarily want to go and be with their kids.
Well, we believed pretty early that part of Koresh's allowing the children to leave was to secure the loyalty of their parents. Parents that have to worry about a child in a compound would be less likely to engage in violence and jeopardize their children. So I think by removing the children, they all came out with little name tags that they were supposed to be sent off to relatives here, there, whatever, that he felt that now they were prepared to die to defend him. What we did in response to that is we did not ship the children off. We left them there in very good care of Texas Child Protective Services. And we told the parents, hey, your kids are here waiting for you to come out and resume your parental responsibility. So we tried to counter his effort to gain their loyalty by placing a lot of doubt in their minds that that they had attended to their children's affairs and now they could go on and work in his behalf.
Gary, when you're working on a situation that is pretty clearly going to last a long time, and had you had your way, it would have lasted perhaps longer and ended differently. But what's a typical work day like? I mean, how close are you staying to the site that you're going to? Are you available around the clock? How does it work?
Well, what I think the public doesn't understand in a lot of situations, and certainly the case in complex ones like a prison riot or a Davidian compound, something like that, there's large teams of negotiators. We probably had as many as 8 negotiators per 12-hour shift. As the overall negotiation leader, I worked a good bit of both shifts, so I wasn't getting a lot of sleep back then, but I was sort of a bridge between the two shifts to make sure we had continuity and continuation of the same strategy. So the negotiators are in – we were at the Texas Technical College where we set up a command post, and it was from that location several miles from the compound where we engaged in our negotiations over the phone with Koresh and more often his number two man, Steve Snyder.
So as things start to progress, the media is very critical. There are a lot of people who are saying, why is this not ending, even from completely outside the federal government. And then the tactical team that was working on this started behaving much more aggressively.
I think there was a lot of frustration. And part of that, I think, rested in the fact that the tactical guys, the guys who are out there in the cold and the wet, under the risk of being shot at, weren't really being provided sufficient information about what we were doing as negotiators and why we were doing it. Rumors abounded that we were sending stakes in and that we were complying with every request or demand that Koresh made.
So they're thinking, why coddle these people that have killed federal agents?
Exactly. And that's exactly right. And you know, we need to tighten the noose and put more pressure and make them do what we want. Well, we know that that's the paradox of power. The harder you push, the more people resist. But the tactical guys, I think, were frustrated. And what we've done after that incident in the FBI is to make sure that those tactical guys know very well what the negotiation team is doing and why, and that we combat this misinformation that unfortunately was allowed to persist at Waco.
So you were back home at the moment that this was all finished, watching it on TV like the rest of America. Can you describe your emotions?
After I left Waco, I flew to the Middle East for another activity in the FBI. And as soon as I came back, I was told that I would either be returning to Waco again or going to another prison riot that had started in Ohio. So I was told to go into the FBI command post. And when I got there, I was told that they were going to put tear gas in that day. So there was no sense in me going to Waco. So I watched it from the FBI's command post at FBI headquarters in Washington. And I saw the tear gas going in, and no people were coming out. And Eventually, the fire started and engulfed the compound. It's hard to express my emotion. I simply got up and left. I didn't tell anybody I was leaving. I didn't ask permission. I just walked out of the building. It was the saddest moment in my FBI career. I got on the phone that night and spoke to every single negotiator who had been out there and told them that it wasn't their fault and praised them for having helped secure the safety of 35 people. It was a very sad and unfortunate thing. The next day I got on a plane and flew to Ohio for an ongoing prison riot. So those were pretty emotionally heavy times for me.
How do you stay sane?
Well, I suppose it's like any other specialty. I mean, a surgeon in a hospital that deals with trauma develops an ability to cope with that tremendously emotional carnage that he or she may see every day. Well, I think it's like that as a negotiator. I'm not suggesting it doesn't affect you, but you put your emotions aside, you put them in check, and allow yourself to concentrate. It's that self-control issue I mentioned before, Chris, that I think was hopefully what made me successful and what I tried to instill in other negotiators.
Was it tough on your family life?
It was. It had a big impact. The fact that I've been married 36 years is one of the great mysteries in life. And I have three grown, wonderful children. And I tell people I was married 36, but I was only home for about 15. And, you know, it was a big challenge. And my wife, I could not have done the job I had if she had not been able to be home and mind the home fires. And so I'm a very fortunate man. But you need that family support and that support of your fellow colleagues to really be successful in this business. And I will comment, I mentioned the team before, what really helps negotiators cope with these things more than anything else is we function in almost all situations in a team context. Mm-hmm. So when I'm the voice of the negotiation team, the primary negotiator, I'm really forwarding the strategies and ideas and representations that the team has agreed to. So we're using the collective experience and wisdom of the team in dealing with the person we're dealing with. So I don't take much credit for the success, nor do I take all the blame if something doesn't happen badly. We're together.
Gary Nestner is my guest. He's former chief negotiator for the FBI. We're talking about his new book, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. He's in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. Learn about that at dfwworld.org. If you want to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372. Jeff Whittington has joined this portion of the conversation. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. I want to thank Mary A. Leslie in Dallas, Doug and Carol Wright in Dallas, Alan Terrell in Weatherford, and Amy Howard in Grapevine. All of them have called 888-694-6931 or contributed online at KERA.org. They've all made that move and said, I'm a part of KERA. I want to help pay for it. I want to make sure that this station and public radio in North Texas has a place in the future right here in our community. So you can do your part if you'll join them, if you'll call 888-694-6931, or if you'll go online to KERA.org and contribute something. We're $135,616 away from the end of the drive. You don't have to do all that. You can, of course, if you'd like to, but just whatever's right for you, whether it's $35 or $350, you get to decide. But please make that decision now.
Good things happen in a community because people make them happen, because people take the time and make the effort to really contribute to what makes them strong. It's a little bit like taking care of your house. You know, you can buy a house and really do nothing to it for years on end, but, you know, the paint starts to peel and the shutters start to get loose. And, you know, it's maintenance that allows it to get better every year. And that's how we feel about KERA. It's not just maintenance. We're also sort of paying the mortgage, but you're paying for this content. Your investment in the station allows it to continue improving as opposed to falling into disrepair. And we appreciate all of you who have recognized that and who have gotten in touch with us at KERA.org or at 1-888-694-6931. Several of you have chosen to receive as your thank you gift the new book, Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator by Gary Nestner. That's available at or above the $120 contribution level.
Yeah, and you should know that it is out. It is available. We're not asking, we're not selling you the book, obviously. We're doing the shopping for you, in a sense, and giving you an opportunity to support the station and get something that may have sparked your imagination or your curiosity about a really intriguing way of making a living and protecting a portion of the country and being out there serving. And it's really fascinating, and, you know, it's a lot different than you might think from from the CSI shows or the thrillers that you see. It's not necessarily Jack Bauer territory, but it is fascinating, and I think that you'll really enjoy. If you're enjoying this conversation, you'll really enjoy the book.
It's also great to hear all these stories from someone who is actually there, as opposed to someone coming in afterward and trying to recreate what happened and having little interviews. It's when you hear from the individual who was directly involved, there's a certain veracity to the information that you can't duplicate. And we're really proud to be able to bring this to you as a show. We know that you enjoy this sort of content, and we ask that you vote for it with your dollars at 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org.
Now, Chris, I'm personally fascinated by this field because, my father was in law enforcement for his career, and I got last year the really incredible opportunity to participate in the Dallas FBI Citizens Academy last fall. And we did have a unit on hostage and crisis negotiation. We all got to kind of experience how difficult it really is to solve situations when tempers are flaring. And the work that those folks do is really commendable. It's incredible work. And we know right here in Dallas-Fort Worth that they've saved a lot of lives just in the last couple of years, if you remember some of the situations that have arisen around downtown Dallas. So we're really thrilled to have Gary Nestner here today. I know that many of you are fascinated by this topic as well. I'm the one that reads your emails, so I know that you really are enjoying this. So we just ask that you do one more thing. And we love that you listen. We love that you call and write in. But we ask that you do that one more thing and support the station that brings you this kind of deep conversation on a topic that you find fascinating.
I think the nicest suit I ever saw you wear to work was on the day that you graduated from that program. I was almost afraid to ask you. Maybe you had a funeral to go to or something.
The day they shot my ID photo, right?
The number to call to support KERA is 1-888-694-6931. You can also go online to kera.org. We would love to give you a copy of Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. That's available to you at the $120 contribution level or above. Thanks to Coyote Oyedepo in Dallas and Charles Prizant in Dallas, also Frank Holterhoff in Louisville and Linda Somerville in Granbury. We would also love to thank you to read your name on the air. It just takes a call or an online contribution.
888-694-6931. Or you know what? If you want to even make your contribution a little cheaper for the station, just go online and make it online safely and securely at kera.org. You fill out the information yourself. You click submit and it's done. And you'll know that for the next year, your membership is current and you've done your part to continue to keep public radio as a reality right here in North Texas. Please do it now, kera.org, and thanks.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Gary Nestner, who is former chief negotiator for the FBI. His new book is called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. We'll go to the phones now and speak with Bill in Arlington. Hi, Bill.
Well, hello, Chris. Hello. And hello, Mr. Nestner.
Hi, Chris. Bill, how are you?
I'm doing fine. My question or comment is that I've been profiling personalities for years, and I use it in the workplace, and I have a comment on the Koresh incident. From what I can tell, and you're going to have to give the listeners a definition, but when you were successful with Koresh, when he handed over the children, I would venture to say that you had that you were neutralizing the random actor in him, and when everything went to pieces, it's that thing that the random actor in him was actually being enraged. I will listen to your comment off the air. Thank you.
Well, I'm not sure that that I really understand that what you mean by that, but I mean, David Koresh was a complex personality, and I think it's easy to attach labels and make mistakes. As a negotiator, I always try to convince, or try to teach rather, negotiators not to go quick to labeling someone antisocial, psychotic, whatever it might be, because then we begin to treat them as we think someone that has that condition is supposed to behave. So I try to really focus on what are the manifestations of his behavior. I will tell you with David Koresh, in my judgment, the overwhelming characteristics he projected were manipulation of others, control of others. A lot of those are the attributes we see in the so-called antisocial personality. David Koresh, whatever his true beliefs were in his religious ideology, I think were secondary. The main issue for him was religion and his interpretation of the Bible was his way to control the people who surrounded him and believed fervently in everything he told them.
Sitting here talking about the way that you're able to take these incredibly difficult people and often convince them to see their way clear to do something that will save lives and achieve, you know, a positive end, it strikes me that a lot of people in HR could use this kind of training. Can you talk a little bit about the applications of this to everyday life for people who, God willing, will never have to deal with anything of this magnitude?
Yeah, in the law enforcement negotiation business, we really transitioned very significantly to a crisis intervention model starting in the 90s, and I think the FBI was instrumental in spreading that around the country. And what that basically is we try to be very, very good listeners. People expect the police to show up at these tense situations and be very commanding and confrontational and ordering them to come out. Instead, when a negotiator says, I want to know what happened today, what's gone on between you and your wife or you and your employer, listening is the cheapest concession we can make. So being genuine and showing respect, everybody, no matter how difficult their background, wants to be shown respect and be given dignity. So if we can do those things, it helps to forge a relationship that now we get to a point where somebody says, gee, Gary, I just don't know what to do. And what I'm hearing when I hear that is now the person's more receptive to me saying, well, have you thought about this as an alternative to violence? You know, when situations are resolved, I used to get in the habit of asking perpetrators why they surrendered. What did the negotiator say that made you come out? Invariably, they would say, I don't remember what they said, he or she, but I liked the way they said it. And if you stop to think about that, it speaks volumes. You can make verbal mistakes as a negotiator, but if you project an overall sincerity, you're going to be successful. And that's true in life, whether we're dealing with our spouses, our children, our coworkers, people we meet in the street, somebody, a neighbor that might be angry at us. If we can take the time to keep in check our own emotions and listen to them and acknowledge what they're feeling, it's a powerful way to create a positive relationship.
Does that focus on the other person's emotions actually help you to keep your own emotions in check?
Well, I think it does. I think, again, if we allow ourselves, the old saying about it takes two people to argue, if we allow this angry outburst directed against us to cause us to respond in kind, then we're really beginning to lose control. I used to use a very simple graphic to teach negotiators, and it's the childhood teeter-totter. And in that teeter-totter, one end is emotions and one is rationality. And when emotions are high, rationality is really low, mm-hmm. i.e. bad decision-making. So what the negotiator's job is and what somebody's job in life when dealing with somebody that's angry, we have to slowly lower that emotional level. And when the emotions come down, you can see that the rationality rises. And that's what we're trying to achieve. So it's really not so much a brilliant argument from the negotiator that leads to an outcome. It's a process.
Did these skills come in handy when you were raising your three kids as teenagers?
My wife will tell you that none of this works at home. There would be times where I would say, well, honey, you sound very angry at me. And she'd wave her finger at me and say, don't try that here. Familiarity does create some issues. But yes, I think it helped me to be a better spouse. And I think it really helped me to be a better parent. A lot of times when we're raising kids and when they're young, it's at the time in our careers where we are the most detached and busy and focused elsewhere. And sometimes it's the old Cats in the Cradle song by Harry mm-hmm. Chapin. You know, you keep putting off this time with your child, and next thing you know, there's no more time left. So I think you really have to stop what you're doing and give them your undivided attention and really listen to what's going on in their lives. And it's important for fathers. We tend to want to tell our kids what they need to do, when in reality, the biggest example we can set is by them simply watching how we live our lives, how we treat other people, how we respect their mother, how we're responsible in paying our bills and taking care of our house and whatever it might be. That speaks volumes rather than the old fatherly lecture.
Are we getting better as a society at listening to each other? It seems like we do a lot of barking at one another.
Well, I'm afraid I see a trend where we're going the opposite direction. And I don't, the book is not meant to be a political book, but certainly the discourse today in our country is very divisive. And I see a lot of sound bites being thrown out and people labeling other people this, that, or the other, when I think a more thoughtful approach to listening to others' points of view, even though you may not agree with it, it may be quite different from your own, but acknowledging their point of view, as I said, listening is a very cheap concession to make. I think it's the respectful and right thing to do, and it helps us avoid an escalation of emotion that then cuts off communication altogether.
Did you find that happened with a lot of the people that you dealt with who were in these crisis situations, that initially, at least, they felt like conceding anything even to you would hurt their position?
Oh, absolutely. There's a lot of folks that feel as though, I know what you're trying to do to me. You're trying to get me to do this or that. Now, if you're sincere and you don't come across as you're trying to manipulate them, you can eventually get to a point where they really believe that sincerity. And from my point of view, it needs to be genuine from the negotiator. But yeah, there's a lot of people that will initially, because of that high emotional state of arousal that I mentioned, will resist all efforts of law enforcement. There are a lot of cases where negotiation teams, it takes them hours just to get the person to begin to talk with them. What we do in those cases, even though the individual refuses to talk with, we begin, rather than just saying over and over, talk to us, talk to us, we begin to say things like, we know you must be concerned about why we're here. You know, we know you may think we're wanting to hurt you, but we want to assure you we don't. We can begin to address their fears, even though they haven't even articulated them to us yet. Just by the nature of the situation, we begin to say things. Because someone's not talking doesn't mean they're not listening.
Do some people respond better to a female negotiator and some to a male?
In some cases, we typically don't try to match up gender, but I will say, of course, women are playing a larger part in law enforcement as through the years, certainly compared to when I started out. Women, I think, have a tendency to be more empathic than men. They tend to be very good listeners. And more importantly, in the eyes of the person that's in this situation, they're less threatening than the more stereotypical, you know, authoritative male voice. That's not to suggest at all that there aren't some just truly outstanding male negotiators. So, and I've seen some lady negotiators who aren't really up to the level they should be. So, but I do think there is something about women tending to be a little bit better listeners that comes in handy in a lot of situations.
Last thing I want to ask you briefly, is there anything that occurred to you about your career as you sat down to write this memoir that hadn't really occurred to you as a theme before that time?
Well, I wanted to tell a personal journey, and I wanted to tell how the profession of negotiations had evolved to become a truly life-saving profession. We have no way of even determining the thousands of lives that have been saved across this country and around the world by negotiators. I wish we did, because I think it's an unheralded, underappreciated profession within law enforcement. But truly, some of the most outstanding law enforcement officers I've ever known have been in negotiations. And maybe the biggest reason I wanted to write the book, I think, is to really spread their message to their bosses, who they may not have direct access to or influence with, to say, listen, you need to support this team of negotiators out there doing this sort of thing. You need to understand the dynamics of these confrontations and why we need to de-escalate those. So I'm not sure that I really answered your question there, Chris, but those were the things that I was thinking about in writing the book. And also, could the skills that we learned in negotiations have applicability to everyday life? And I believe they do.
Gary, thank you so much for your time with us today.
It's my great pleasure.
The new book by Gary Noesner, who is former chief negotiator for the FBI, is called Stalling for Time, My Life as an FBI Hostage Negotiator. He is in town to speak to the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. That takes place this evening at 6 at the Fairmont Hotel in Dallas. You can learn more about the appearance at dfwworld.org. If you would like to receive a copy of Gary Noesner's book, we would love to offer it to you as a thank you gift at the $120 level or above this afternoon. You can do that online at kera.org. You can also go to 1-888-694-6931. I want to thank all of you who have already done that today and throughout this fundraising drive. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Chris. The people have been calling and going online to get Gary Noesner's book, Stalling for Time, at the $120 membership level. Thanks so much for that. Chris, you want to guess what the most popular thank you gift has been during this membership campaign?
Ken Burns DVD extravaganza?
That is correct. Yeah. At the $240 level, The War with six DVDs, National Parks, six DVDs, The Baseball, including the 10th inning, 11 DVDs plus bonus CDs. It's 23 DVDs and two CDs for a $240 contribution at 888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. You want to guess what the number two is?
Number two, People's Pharmacy.
That is correct. You are correct.
Wow.
Again, Chris Boyd. It's a lot easier when Brian Garner is not giving you these questions. the book, People's Pharmacy, Recipes and Remedies, again, not available anywhere but right here in this market. It's not available in stores right now. It's yours when you join the station at the $120 membership level. Thanks to everyone who has taken us this far. We just have $135,341 left to raise. And your call right now, your online contribution at KERA.org, is going to get us there.
1-888-694-6931 is the telephone number. You can also go to KERA.org online. Think about why you listen to public radio. Just take a moment and think about, you know, what else you could be doing, but instead you choose to listen to public radio. That is the reason right there. That is your reason for supporting public radio. You pay for content in so many other places. You don't expect to walk into the movies and not pay. You don't expect to have cable TV at your house and not pay for it. You don't expect to walk into a bookstore and take home a book to keep and not have it. We ask that you think about KERA in the same way. We're not able to sort of stop you with a censor at the door. We're happy that the content is available all the time because we do know that, you know, for a limited number of you, it would be impossible to send a contribution. For most of us, though, you know, if things are okay, if you're working, it certainly is possible to pay for the content you consume. And we would ask you to please think about this as a contribution, not just to you, but to the welfare and the sort of civil discourse throughout North Texas.
888-694-6931 is the place to do it, or, of course, online at KERA.org. You're absolutely right, Chris. This is your opportunity, folks. You don't have to do a whole lot. Just do a little. If everybody who listens to the station, if everyone did a little contribution, like $10 or $20, we would be able to raise between $4 and $8 million.
I'm laughing because it sounds like I tell my kids, if everybody would just put their glass in the dishwasher as soon as they, you know, finished, it would be. But it's true.
Well, yeah, and everybody doing their part together really does make things, you know, things
many
work
hands
better.
Make light work.
Exactly. If everybody wanted to drive whichever way they wanted on the freeway, we'd never get anywhere. Sometimes it feels like that way anyway. But no, we all agree to go reasonably similar speeds and reasonably the same direction. And that's how we get where we need to go. And so on the radio membership campaign, this thing that we've been doing for a while, we just hope that you'll agree to go in the same direction and at a reasonable amount. Contribute that to KERA.
And I'm going to maybe torture your metaphor here, but we're all going maybe in the same direction. Everybody has a different destination. That's public radio is not trying to steer you in a certain way politically. We're not trying to tell you how to live your life. We are just trying to explore ideas and make sure that you understand you have all the road signs and the road maps that you need to make your own decisions about where you're going.
Absolutely. And we're not in any position to make any kind of decision about what you want to contribute. That's why it's not the same for everyone. If we came out and it was a monolithic, it's $100 to join the station. Well, it's not that. It's as low as $35 to be a member. And you know what? You can give $5 if you want. As a matter of fact, a lot of people give a small contribution here and there throughout the year. During each drive or during several times of the same drive to help us make a goal or to help us get that little extra push. Well, we could really use that right now at 888-694-6931 or online at KERA.org. We could set it up so that to download the podcast to this show, you could pay $1 and get it. But we didn't. We could set it up so that to get the brand new KERA iPhone app at KERA.org/app. We could set that up so you could pay a nominal fee and get it, but we didn't. We made it free. We could set it up so that you had to pay to stream or that you had to pay to get the news reports or to access the Art and Seek website content, but you don't. It's all free. And then we come to you a couple of times a year because that's how it's set up. And we say, hey, didn't you enjoy all that? You've already used it. It costs money to make. So why not send some money back to the station?
Now, there might be some people sitting out there saying, well, you should have because you could have made some money that way. The truth is we want the content to be out there. We want it to be available. And we trust that, you know, when we have these fundraising drives that you will recognize your part in keeping public radio strong. And so many of you do. And we just cannot thank you enough for your contribution. We know it's voluntary, and we appreciate that you not only give us the money, but honestly, make the effort, because sometimes that's the biggest step of all, is just getting mm-hmm. you to go ahead and do it. You can get in touch with us right now at KERA.org, or you can call 1-888-694-6931. You might choose to receive the new book by Gary Nesner, Stalling for Time, available today at or above the $120 contribution level. Thanks so much.
The Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.